Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who examines the legality of a U.S. war on Iraq, given the Bush administration's failure to obtain U.N. authority for an attack on Baghdad. Redmond Handy, a retired colonel in the Air Force Reserves, who discusses his belief that the U.S. military's mandatory anthrax vaccination program presents a clear and present danger to human health. And Karen Strickler, founder of the group 50 Plus One, who analyzes the so-called partial birth abortion ban, which recently passed in the Senate, and that critics charge is intended to ban all abortion rights for women. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
With the United Nations Security Council fractured over Iraq, world leaders gathered in Geneva on March 11th to launch the International Criminal Court, now recognized by 89 nations, but shunned by the Bush administration. 18 judges were sworn in at a ceremony at The Hague as a permanent tribunal to investigate cases of individuals who commit war crimes or crimes against humanity. The ICC is the product of the 1998 Treaty of Rome that was crafted in the wake of the genocide in Rwanda. The U.S. has opposed the treaty from the outset out of a fear that American troops or key officials could be the targets of war crimes investigations. The new court is strongly backed by the European Union and recognized by many American allies, including Colombia, South Korea, and Afghanistan. Other powers, such as China, Russia, and Japan, signed the accord, but have yet to ratify the treaty. Once in office, President George Bush removed Bill Clinton's signature from the ICC treaty and sought complete legal immunity for all Americans from the court's jurisdiction. While the ICC may not launch any investigations until next year, there is talk of tribunals against rebel leaders in the Ivory Coast and the Congo. According to The Economist magazine, the International Bar Association wants to see war crimes charges filed against Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe. Jordan's Prince Zayed al-Hussein summed up the ICC's mission for international justice as not a crucible for vengeance, but a court of last resort for victims of war crimes. The Christian Science Monitor reports that the U.S. Army has a new mission in war-torn Colombia to protect a 500-mile oil pipeline from guerrilla attacks. U.S. attention is focused on the Cano Limón complex, which is partially owned by Occidental Petroleum. It is located in the ravaged state of Arauca, just 6 miles from the Venezuelan border. In 2001, the leftist Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, and the National Liberation Army, or the ELN, attacked the pipeline 170 times, which stalled construction for 7 months at a cost of $500 million to the Colombian government. Last fall, the U.S. Congress agreed to spend $98 million to equip troops to protect the oil pipeline. The U.S. Army is also backing efforts to protect Colombia's roads and electrical towers from rebel attack. Adam Isaacson of the U.S.-based Center for International Policy sees oil in Colombia as a high priority for the Bush administration in an effort to diversify America's foreign oil supplies. Colombian soldiers will be trained by 70 U.S. military advisors from the 7th Special Forces Group based at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. The U.S. will also provide $71 million to Colombia for the purchase of helicopters and $17 million for additional training programs as part of an overall package of more than $2 billion in U.S. aid. Eugenia Tebeje, a 35-year-old Ethiopian mother, was one of the many villagers who were dying every day in the Amara Highlands. According to the World Press Review magazine, flocks of vultures now signal pending death on Ethiopia's parched lands. Once the scavengers fed off tens of thousands of heads of cattle, but now they are going after people who are dying of hunger and malnutrition. Village leader Taju Bimmer recalls that infants started dying in December, but now middle-aged adults are perishing. The World Food Program says 14 million people in Ethiopia are now facing starvation, one out of every five people in the African nation. There is a long history of deadly famine in the Horn of Africa. During the early 1890s, one-third of the populace perished from hunger, and the 1973 drought cost Emperor Haile Selassie his throne. Critics charge that it is the ever-present international aid agencies who unwittingly foster hunger and disease by supplying food crops that displace local farmers. German aid worker Klaus Feldner blamed the United Nations World Food Program for acting on behalf of rich nations by purchasing subsidized food and sending it to Africa, which only undercuts self-sufficiency efforts and leaves poor nations in chronic underdevelopment. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Echoing the script of an old Western movie, President Bush issued an ultimatum to Saddam Hussein in a March 17th television address that if he and his sons do not leave Iraq within 48 hours, war would be the inevitable result. The Iraqi leader's immediate rejection of Washington's demands set the stage for a war that an overwhelming majority of the world's people and governments oppose. President Bush's failure to win Security Council backing for a resolution authorizing war against Baghdad represented a stinging rejection of the White House argument that Saddam Hussein's regime posed an imminent threat to the U.S. and the world. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan underscored widespread hostility to the Bush position when he said on March 10th, quote, "If the U.S. and others were to go outside the Security Council and take military action, it would not be in conformity with the U.N. Charter. The legitimacy and support for any such action will be seriously impaired." With war all but certain, two groups, the Center for Constitutional Rights and Greenpeace, called on the UN General Assembly to hold an emergency session and adopt the little-known Uniting for Peace Resolution No. 377 to declare a U.S.-British war without Security Council authorization as illegal and a crime against peace. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who explains the Uniting for Peace option and the damage that he fears will be done to the system of international law by a unilateral U.S. war on Iraq.
The Security Council is really is a very undemocratic body. It has five big powers, not the biggest, for example. India is not in there, but neither is Germany, but it has five veto-bearing countries in there, and there's 191 countries in the United Nations. You could argue that the more democratic institution would be the General Assembly. And there is a procedure that the United States actually set up because of the Soviet veto in the 50s. That procedure is one in which if there's a deadlock or if there's a threat to international peace and security in the Security Council, and the Security Council can't solve it, and in this case, of course, there is such a deadlock or lack of unanimity or a threat because the U.S. is about to go to war without the authority it needs, then the matter can be moved to the General Assembly. The General Assembly can vote on what's called a Uniting for Peace resolution. The name is obvious. It's Uniting for Peace and not war. It was first used by the United States, actually, in the General Assembly after France and Britain attacked Egypt to take over the Suez Canal after Egypt had nationalized the Suez Canal under Gamal Abdel Nasser. The French and the Israelis and the British went in to take that canal. Obviously, any resolution would be vetoed in the Security Council. And so the U.S. decided, heck with this, we'll move this whole matter into the General Assembly. They did. The General Assembly voted that U.K. and France had to get out of Egypt and out of the Suez Canal. They did. It was within a week of that resolution, and the matter was resolved peacefully, essentially. So that is the best use. It hasn't always been as effective. It's only been used 10 times, let's start there, so it's very rare. Most people on this radio show probably have never heard of it. Most U.N. officials probably don't know about it. Or UN countries. We made sure that's not the case anymore. We've sent it to every single one of the embassies, and we've met with all the missions in New York that we can so that they're aware of it. So it can be used. Will it be successful? I don't know. I certainly think it's an important vote if we can get it, 170, 180 votes against the United States. But I must say, the United States already looks pretty isolated to me. I mean, the so-called summit in the Azores really comes down to, I think, making the United States look worse, not better. The fact is, you had three stinking countries out there out of a world of 191 countries. You know, it looks more like a coalition of the bullies.
George Bush has stated that the United Nations is irrelevant because of the opposition to his war plans on the Security Council. But if this war is launched, how does that damage the institution of the United Nations that was created to keep the peace and to at least build international consensus for war if there was agreement that there had to be war?
You know, I think in some way that is the question people are asking, and all the newspapers ask that. I think that's the wrong question. I think the right question here is, how does this damage the United States? The Security Council and the United Nations have actually did something that was remarkable here. They have stood up to the most powerful country in the world that tried to coerce each of these countries with everything from cash bribes like Turkey to other kinds of bribes, whether it's joining NATO or NAFTA or other kinds of things. And they have stood tall here, essentially. They have said to the United States, biggest military power, biggest political power, biggest, they have said no, despite this. So the United Nations has actually played the right role here. It has said no. It's the United States, I think, that has lost the credibility here, and a tremendous amount of credibility. It's basically thrown out the system that we have used to govern the world since the Second World War. You know, in fact, the UN, I think, would have become irrelevant had it gone along with the United States. Had it just simply voted for war, even after a struggle, that would be it saying, we can be coerced, we can be bullied, the superpower controls the whole thing. Now we actually have a different world out there. We have a world in which we can say the superpower may not control the whole thing.
Michael, it seems that as we speak, war is inevitable. And what are some of your feelings, and what in your mind should activists be doing at this moment?
Well, my first feelings are, you know, how sad I am for the people who are going to be facing those bombs. I mean, you know, they've talked about what's called shock and awe, which is 3,000 cruise missiles going right into Baghdad. Well, you know, those things cannot be precise enough to hit only military targets. They're going to wipe out the electrical grid, and they're going to kill a lot of civilians. So the first thing is the real sense that I think all of us have is the tragedy of any war, which indicates to me the incredible necessity of the people of the world to do everything they can, whether it's this war or the future, to stopping war. And that's my optimism, which is that we've basically built up a worldwide peace movement that no longer finds war as an acceptable way to solve problems. Your next question is harder, of course, because once the war starts, it can no longer really stop at least the initial war. But obviously, I think people have to massively hit the streets in protest against this war basically say, we don't agree with this war. We don't agree that war should be a first resort. It should be an absolute last resort, if at all. And this is not a case where we were in danger, and should make basically this administration pay a price for it. I would include in that demonstrations, I would include civil disobedience. I would certainly include, you know, when it comes down to that time, voting out of office, those people who voted for this war. So I want people to get out there and do something. You know, I'm optimistic about it. I've never seen such a fast-growing peace movement in my life. I mean, a year ago I was very pessimistic. You know, we're facing all these civil liberties blowback. We're facing, you know, people, you know, in the seat of government who seem to be incredibly popular. We're facing a world that seemed cowed by them. And now we see a different situation. We see a worldwide peace movement of people moving with their feet and with their bodies and with their voices. We see the Internet able to connect those people. We see, for example, even in my own small field of lawyers, we see lawyers across the world uniting to try and say there has to be justice against what these people are doing, you know, fighting in the UN. I'm actually, in terms of that, I'm very optimistic and believe it is something we haven't seen for scores of years. I think people are just sick and tired of war, and sick and tired of a country like the United States going to war on pretext when it's really trying to essentially redraw the map of the world so that the United States can continue to dominate and be this remaining and only superpower for the next 100 years.
That was Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center at area code 212-614-6464. Or visit the group's website at www.ccr-ny.org. As U.S. troops once again prepare for war against Iraq, renewed concern and scrutiny are being focused on mandatory immunizations given to American soldiers. Starting with the first Persian Gulf War, hundreds of thousands of U.S. service personnel received a series of vaccination shots to protect them from anthrax. The Pentagon says the inoculation program is a force protection measure, but critics call it a biological loyalty test. They point out that the vaccination has never been approved for its current use of protecting troops from possible inhalation anthrax in a biowarfare setting, as the drug is only approved for cutaneous exposure in an industrial setting. Contrary to the information put out by the Defense Department, which asserts that the anthrax vaccination is safe, scientific studies reveal it has an extremely high rate of harmful reactions. The package insert that comes with the vaccine, produced by the company Bioport, lists 60 known side effects and 6 fatalities tied to the drug. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Redmond Handy, a colonel in the Air Force Reserves who retired in protest against the forced vaccination of troops. He has studied the anthrax inoculation program for the past 4 years and discusses its impact on human health, consequences for those who refuse to take the shots, and efforts to encourage the military to adopt a voluntary participation policy.
We had indications from the Gulf War that this shot was problematic. 150,000 service members took it, most of them without their knowledge, and many of them did not have their shot records annotated. Many who did not deploy but took the shot got as sick with similar symptoms compared to service members who actually deployed and got exposed to other toxic substances overseas, such as oil well fires, chemical agents, pesticides, whatever. So there was some familiarity that this shot was not a pure product.
Does everyone in the military have to get this shot?
Initially, Secretary of Defense William Cohen, that started the second phase of this after the Gulf War, decided that everybody in uniform would get this, and they actually administered about 2 million doses to 500,000 service members between 1998 and 2001. But then the new program is more reserved. It doesn't seem to be an intention to give it to everybody, at least right now, although that could change. The current administration is only giving it to folks who are deploying. The problem is that there's no protocol for stopping, you know, these series of shots that service members were getting as of about a year or a year and a half ago and starting them up again. And even though the manufacturing process has been upgraded with new equipment and hopefully better quality control, the shot form is still the same. There was quite a policy change that happened February 2000, after a congressional report came out really condemning the program quite severely and recommending that the shot be given on a voluntary basis instead of a mandatory basis. They didn't appreciate the idea of being forced to take something that they thought had a good chance of not being effective and certainly had a poor safety record. Pentagon contends that it was safe enough from their perspective. You know, service members are looking at the data, and when they see things like there are 1,600 reaction reports filed with the FDA on this shot, making it the most, as they say, reactogenic shot on the market, they get a little concerned, especially when you consider that usually only 1% of the real reaction rate or incidences are filed. That's according to the FDA's own estimate. So you could, instead of 1,600, you could be talking, 160,000 reactions in reality. And then the military reports these at a lower rate than the civilian population because it's incredibly important to be in shape, be able to be gung-ho and do your job. And if there's a physical problem, chances are you're going to be reassigned and not do your job. And on top of that, you have pressure from commanders and military medical policymakers who so believe in this shot that it becomes a biological loyalty test as opposed to a force protection measure.
Can you say a little more about the side effects of getting the anthrax shot? And has anybody died from getting it?
I've watched 2 people die a very slow death, very creeping paralysis over a number of months. Typical reactions may range anywhere from headaches to nausea to swollen arms. Very typical reactions also include joint, bone, and muscle aches and pains that are often chronic and don't go away. I know some individuals have had lowered testosterone levels, which has been a very traumatic experience for several guys. This is an amazing situation that a product that has been criticized as contaminated and adulterated is allowed to continue in public commerce and has gone from the previous package label, which claimed only a 2.2% severe reaction rate, to as high as now the new label says up to 35% of severe reaction rate. And the Army's own study showed it was as high as 48% that this product is still in use.
What would happen if an active duty service person or a reservist who's called up were going to be shipped to the Gulf and refused to get the shot?
Whoever would get activated or deployed to get the shot, if they want to refuse it, I have very little option, really. They face anything from what they call non-judicial administrative punishment up to and including court-martial and dishonorable discharge, which means you have a felony criminal record. The Army Times Publishing Company poll in May of 1999, which was a poll of service members what they thought about the shot, and 77% of them said that they thought it should be voluntary, that it was wrong to force them to take it. Okay. Shortly thereafter, USA Today came out with a poll that showed that 90% of Americans disagreed with forcing service members to take the shot. So I guess the question is, do we have a democracy or not? I mean, the people have spoken, and those who we have assigned power to implement the will of the people have not paid attention and ignored this to the detriment of service members who are getting sick and dying.
That was Redmond Handy, a consultant to the National Gulf War Resource Center. Contact the center by calling area code 1-800-882-1316 or visit the group's website at www.ngwrc.org. On Thursday, March 13th, the Senate voted to pass the deceptively named partial birth abortion ban. The Republican-controlled Senate passed the bill 64-33, with 16 Democrats voting in favor. Similar bills passed the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate several times before, but were vetoed by then-President Bill Clinton because they did not include an exemption to protect a pregnant woman's health. The term partial birth abortion was first introduced 8 years ago by the anti-choice movement and cannot be found in any medical dictionary. The language of the bill is vaguely worded, and critics charge this is intentional, so conservative judges appointed by President Bush can then interpret the legislation to broadly ban safe and commonly used abortion procedures. Washington Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell stated the abortion ban, quote, unconstitutionally restricts women's rights no matter where a woman is in her pregnancy. The bill is expected to pass in the House later this year and be signed into law by President Bush, but opponents of the legislation will almost certainly try to overturn the ban by appealing to the Supreme Court. Karen Strickler is the founder and executive director of 50 Plus One, a group she led in a campaign to defeat the so-called partial birth abortion ban in Maryland in 1998. She spoke with Between the Lines' Denise Manzari and says the ban is still not recognized for what it is, part of a carefully crafted national strategy to ban all abortion.
Roe versus Wade, the 1973 decision that legalized abortion in this country, allows abortion approximately up until the point of viability. That's the point at which the fetus can live outside the womb. After that, Roe versus Wade says that a woman cannot have an abortion unless the pregnancy threatens her life or health. But the point is that the anti-choice crowd is not after banning late-term abortion. Roe versus Wade already does that, but makes these very reasonable exceptions to protect a woman's life or health.
So what you're saying is that the supporters of this ban are not actually trying to ban the late-term or third trimester abortions, but actually their ultimate goal is to eradicate Roe v. Wade and
exactly.
ban abortion from any point in the pregnancy.
Exactly. They're after all abortions at all stages of pregnancy. And the way that one can verify that is because in this so-called partial birth abortion ban legislation, there is no mention of stage of pregnancy. There are several ways that one can talk about stages of pregnancy. People can talk about trimesters, viability, as you and I just did, weeks of gestation. But in this so-called partial birth abortion ban, there is no mention of stage of pregnancy. So to call it a ban on late-term abortions is factually inaccurate. The next evidence that they're after all abortion is the fact that the definition of so-called partial birth abortion is very broad, and federal courts and the United States Supreme Court have all said that it's broad enough to encompass a lot of different types of abortion procedures at many different stages of pregnancy. One very interesting thing is that the term partial birth abortion itself can't be found in any medical dictionary. And that's because it's not a medical term. It's a political term that anti-choice advocates made up in order to stigmatize abortion. And when they talk about these bans, they use very graphic language about late-term abortions that's different from anything found in the prohibitions in their bill, in the legislation itself. In fact, they were chastised for that by the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists. They represent OBGYN specialists. And they've rejected these bans, saying that they fail to use recognized medical terminology, and they fail to define explicitly what procedure is prohibited. You know, remind yourself once again, you know, you say, what is partial birth abortion? Well, there is no medical term called partial birth abortion. They specifically chose not to use a recognized medical term. Why? Because they're trying to pull a fast one on us all. They're trying to broadly ban abortion, and they don't want us to figure it out before they get it through the U.S. Congress.
The procedures ban that was passed by the Senate has not been supported by the American Medical Association or the American Medical Women's Association or the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
That's correct. The pro-choice people have been talking about the fact that this bill is unconstitutional because it does not contain a post-viability exception for women's health.
Karen Strickler, what would you say to those listening to this program now? Where should they go to get as much information as they can, and what should they do once they have this information?
One of the first things people should do is read the legislation and, again, use the test that I've suggested. If the anti-choice people want to have an honest debate about late-term abortions, then let's talk about that. That's not what this legislation does. In fact, there was a situation on May 14, 1998 in Wisconsin when a so-called partial birth abortion ban had passed in that state, and it came into effect, and on May 14, 1998, every abortion clinic in the state stopped performing abortions. They didn't perform any abortions at any stage of pregnancy because doctors said that the ban was so broad that they could face life imprisonment for any abortion at any stage of pregnancy. And in fact, women only regained their right to safe and legal abortion after prosecutors promised not to prosecute doctors for very early trimester procedures.
That was Karen Strickler, founder of 50 Plus One. Her article, Partial Birth Abortion Bans, Why Does the Big Lie Continue?, can be read online at www.commondreams.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Talk. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Denise Manzari, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.